Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
And I want to welcome you to this event's topic, which is a movie analysis about the movie Titanic. And I hope people saw it because it's a really good movie. And if not, everything will be spoiled. And how I did it before with the two previous movie analysis, I tried first to explain a little bit about the Jungian concepts and then go into a summary of the movie. But the movie is very simpler and very straightforward. So I can do both at the same time. And I will start with a summary about the movie. And the summary goes like this. The 70-year-old aristocrat, Rose, falls in love with a kind but poor artist, Jack Dawson, aboard a luxurious, ill-fated RMS Titanic. Trapped in her current relationship with the rich but vain and arrogant Carl Hockley by her mother, Rose has to fight for her emotional survival amid the sinking ship. She tells her story 84 years later in the current day to a crew searching the Titanic for a treasure she might have the missing information for. So about this movie. At one time, for a very long time, this has been the most successful movie in all time, money-wise. So really a lot of people saw it, and I checked it was something like 118 million tickets sold only in the US. And there are 300 million people living there. So every third person saw it. Some people saw it multiple times, which is very likely. And it stayed on the top spot for many, many years. Came out in the middle of the 90s and was created by James Cameron, one of the most successful and accomplished directors of all time in Hollywood. Famous for more action movies like Terminator 1 and 2 and Aliens and True Lies. And good old James Cameron has a very big passion. And this passion is water and diving and everything underwater. So a couple of years before, the wreck of the Titanic, the real ship, was found. And he wanted to go there and do expeditions. And basically wanted Hollywood to pay for it. So he shopped around in the studios and said he wants to do a movie about the Titanic and he needs money so that he can investigate the real ship lying at the bottom of the ocean. And he pitched it as Romeo and Juliet on a boat. And he was already a household name back then. And the studios wanted to have him involved in their processes. They said yes, even though they were a little bit concerned. They wanted to have more action movies from him. And this is basically a love story. But they agreed, they gave him money. And he spent 2 years to dive multiple times to the Titanic and investigate it and shoot photo material. And the longer he spent time there and the more he investigated, the more he became involved with the human tragedy of the catastrophe of, I think it was 1,500 people dying that night. And with time, he said, okay, I will do this movie, but I want to do it right. And I want to do it justice. And I want to capture the human element completely. He created at that time one of the most expensive movies of all time, where it took two movie studios just to bankroll it. Because he built an almost complete replica of the ship in Mexico. And he had real sets and he had real costumes and he had everything very detailed and very true and authentic. And this, of course, costs a lot of money and a lot of special effects, visual effects, which hold up pretty well till today. The reason why Cameron can do this and do it justice is because he's a very, let's say, possessed director. In the sense that he is incredibly focused on detail and seems to sometimes be hard to work with on the set because he's very detail-oriented and he's very perfectionist. And here we can always start with some Jungian concepts because when a man is incredibly driven in the passions and his interests and everything, in the Jungian sense, he's very likely anima-possessed, which means there is something in him, the feminine function, which causes him to get entangled with the world or with things. And for Jung, it meant if you're really interested and really much in a relationship with your anima as a man, it makes it very hard to connect to a real woman. And similar in James Cameron life, he had multiple marriages, also with successful directors. But this is a man consumed by work and working all the time. And this is a sure sign for Jung that there's the anima playing a pretty big role in the life and the psychology of that person. So going to the movie, we have Rose. And Rose is the protagonist. This is pretty much clear. The movie almost starts with her, and it tells her story, her experience coming to the ship, being on the ship, and then trying to survive the catastrophe. And she's in a special situation because she is psychologically and situationally trapped in her family. So she's an aristocrat, her mother also, but they're basically poor as a family. And she's been promised to another rich man for marriage so that the family can survive. But this also means that she basically can't do anything. She's more like a trophy wife. She cannot decide things for her, and she cannot do things. And there's this extremely strict caste of aristocracy, what it means, how to behave as a woman, how to dress. And this is all incredibly strict. So she is completely trapped. And she herself is pretty smart and well-read and also interested in art and in the world. But of course, she cannot live it out because she has to marry Cal, who is rich, but is a horrible person. And it wouldn't be a love story without the second part. And this part is Jack. And to stay with Jungian terms, Jack is a manifestation of the animus of Rose. And the positive thing about that is that he's a positive manifestation. So going a little bit more into details, Jung saw two fundamental functions in the psyche of people, like way down below everything. And this is Eros and this is Logos. And Eros is a function of connectivity, of binding together, of entangling. And Logos is separation. So very deep down in the psyche, it's either things coming together or things moving apart. And Jung says these functions, everybody has them. All people have Eros and Logos functions. It's just a necessity. It's just that he says people have more of the one or more of the other. They are more at home at Eros or more at home at Logos. And he associates that also Eros with femininity and Logos with masculinity. And he even says that in men, the Logos function, the masculine function, is stronger. And in women, the Eros, the feminine function, is stronger, which does not mean that women don't have a Logos and men do not have an Eros. It's rather people do not feel at home. It's a little bit like handedness. You have two hands. You need both hands. And normally you get two hands with birth, but you have a favorite hand. And if you do something, you first try it with your favorite hand. For Jung, this always means you have something that you like more, but there's also the other thing that you should integrate. You should also have it in your psyche and you should have it in your repertoire to deal with the world and its necessities. But in the beginning, it's in the unconscious. So your consciousness is the things that you know, that you already have and you can do and you can willfully control. This is an important aspect for Jung. The things you can do with direction, with a plan, and you can follow through. These are conscious things and these things you can do. It's same as when you do something with your favorite hand, it will come very easy. It will come very natural. It's a good thing. Like brushing your teeth with your favorite hand, very good. If you want to do it with the other hand, it's always clumsy. It's always not so sophisticated. So brushing your teeth with the other hand, it just feels weird. It feels really, really weird. But you could train yourself to become more proficient also on the other side. In Kung Fu, for example, students, they first learn a technique with their weak hand and then with a strong hand. And Jung says, human beings with a psychology are very prone to just be in their favorite place, the things they can already know. Like, oh, I can do most things with one hand. I use my favorite hand, so I ignore the rest. But in Jungian psychology, you need everything. If you do not pay attention to everything, it will come back and it will push against you to just get your attention so that you spend time with also the weak hand. In the most extreme case, the weak hand can become its own personality, its own agent that tries to do things against your will. So the Evil Dead movies, for example, they have this with a hand that becomes like a living being with its own will. So when your man, or like James Cameron, the female part, the Eros function, is then, of course, represented to the figure of the anima, and this can be attached to certain things or certain persons, most likely people of the opposite sex. So it is like there's already an image of the opposite partner inside the psychology. And very often when people fall in love for first sight, right, it's not that they fall in love with a person because they do not know the person. It's just a face or a figure or a couple of information. It's that people then see this anima or animus in the other person and attracted first to that. Of course, there's things happening in the psychology that the other person corresponds to a certain degree to the image of the opposite sex that one already has within oneself. So it's not completely random. When you find somebody that immediately is attractive, it's very likely that they correspond to a psychological situation within you already, because you don't fall in love with every person in the world, but it's very specific persons. If you would check like all the persons you are interested in, you would find commonalities, and this would hone it into this opposite part within oneself. Jung calls it even the soul image, anima, or the animus, meaning this is really the journey one has to take at a certain point, integrating the other part also. So Jack is, in this movie, in this context, representing the animus of Rose. And he's representing a lot of things that Rose has within her, this sense of knowledge, adventure, and art. But he has so much more. He also has everything that Rose would like to have and like to be. And the interesting thing about the animus is that in a Jungian sense, it's not a single entity. So the anima is a single entity. It's a single, let's say, person internally, psychologically. But for the women, the animus, it's a group of men. Jung wrote pretty late in life about it because he's a man, he's more familiar with the anima, but it's something he noticed in the psychology of patients. And you could see it a little bit like that when you, for example, have a romance story. Very often is that the female protagonist has multiple suitors and love interests, and basically it comes down to a choosing situation where the protagonist chooses the best companion for her. But he says on the flip side, when women look for the animus outside, they see it in a singular person, and then it's that one person. And he says for men, it's one anima internally, but many outside, because basically men are looking for the one anima somewhere, and it could be anywhere. And it's then multiple women. So animus as a multiplicity, as a group of men. And this is something you really have in this movie. You see many different male figures who all show very different masculine behavior. And on the very positive side, there's Jack. And on the very negative side, there's Cal. Because Cal is completely controlling. He's a tyrant, basically. He's deciding whether she smokes or not, what she says or not, what she eats or not. So it's adding to this feeling of entrapment by Rose. And at the same time, and this is interesting about the movie, when he is busy, he is not interested in her, and she can walk around and meet Jack, for example, even though that he controls everything otherwise. When he is occupied, then she's basically free and wandering around on this boat where she can't escape. Jack, in his attributes, is a creative spirit. And this is something that Jung noted, which is special about the unconscious. So all the things that are not you, that are not integrated in consciousness, there is the creative part lying. So when people have ideas and people get certain like intuitions, when there's creative work being generated, this comes out of the unconscious from special places like the collective unconscious, for example. And Jack is that. Jack is an artist. He's creating. And he is very good with words, because logos is also associated with words, with language. And eros is more associated with emotions and moods. I have to be careful about the wording, because there's differences there. But just to explain it, while men are suffering by irrational moods, for example, obsession or depression or all these things that just overcome them suddenly, he said, psychological for women, the problem is that they have bad thoughts suddenly coming up out of nowhere. So while anima-possessed men run around in the world and they're completely entangled in just casual relationships or work or other things, is that women are then in the bad situation when there's a animus possession taking place to have very strong opinions about things that just came up. They're just thoughts and ideas that do not have a ground in anything, but just grip the person and don't let it go. And strong opinionatedness he associated with a certain type of animus possession. So, Jack is, as a representative of the Logos, as the animus, of course, good with words. He is very adapting. He is funny. He's exploring. But he's also, and this is interesting, encouraging and trusting. They form a strong bond immediately. And he's encouraging her, like, all the time. She, in a normal situation, she gets disencouraged all the time by her mother, by Cal. But Jack is there and he encourages her to do things and to try things. So when we have a story and we have a protagonist, this protagonist will, of course, go on to a journey. And this is very often for the stories that we like, or stories that are famous. It is a spiritual journey. It's a transformational journey. And Jung called that individuation. As I said in the beginning, you start out with your hand and you have to find your other hand and maybe all the other hands that could be there, but you do not know of. It's the kind of collecting all the psychological parts that are part of you, but you don't know it yet. So everything that should go together comes together. And this is individuation. This is also meaning becoming individual, becoming whole, and being then separated by things, like moving out of a family circle to stand on one's own feet. And Rose is going on her individuation journey over the course of this movie. And the starting position for her is this entrapment. And this is also the point where she wants to kill herself. And she wants to throw herself over the ship and just drown in the sea. Because there is nothing for her. Everything is sterile. Everything is dead. There's no future. There's no hope. And she is trying to kill herself just to evade the pain. And symbolically speaking, if we would watch this, for example, in dream analysis, we would say this means basically to become unconscious again, to go back into the sphere where you do not experience anything, like a small child. For example, it doesn't have a strong consciousness. Most things just pass it without realizing, or when you're extremely drunk or when you're very sick, you become kind of unconscious. You don't notice all the things anymore. And there's a parallel. There's a story of Sleeping Beauty. The story of Sleeping Beauty is that the parents did not invite the evil queen for the birthday. So the child was cursed. So again, it's a story of you need to include everything, but if not everything is included, horrible things will happen. As soon as Sleeping Beauty hit puberty, she fell asleep because psychologically she's like a child. She's not adapted to all the world and she cannot experience all the world. And then the prince comes and wakes her up. The animus comes and brings her back to life again and saving her. And this is also what's happening in the movie. As soon as she tries to kill herself, Jack appears. Of course, the movie sets it up how it came to be and so on. But psychologically, it's this situation that it's extreme and suddenly unconscious forces become active, also in a helping sense. This would then be the self, the future complete you, reaching out, helping your current you to develop yourself. And this is what she needs in this situation. Then Jack comes and he makes it very, like, funny. He teases her. Like, she's about to jump and he teases her and like, I don't think you will jump. Because it's cold and he's bantering with her, trying to convince her and also trying to save her. And Jung noticed that when you're in a situation where you do not know what to do, because you as a consciousness, what do you know? You're very limited. You have only been here a couple of years. The unconscious becomes active, which is an ancient part full of archetypes, basically human nature. And he noticed that people are suddenly able to act in extreme difficult situations like they would have been in this situation before. And the argumentation for that is the ancient part of your body and of your mind, the human nature, experienced that. Situations happened so often in the past that they become then ingrained as archetypes, as a kind of background program in the psyche. And in extreme situations, it comes out, or in bright situations. And in this case, it's Rose trying to kill herself, and then Jack, as the Animus, appears and saves her. And as she is being saved by Jack, she has this internal switch where she says, I'm feeling drawn to him immediately, of course, because it's her Animus. And I want to be involved with him. And then something very interesting happens, which is basically the rest of the movie. She slips at the railing. So he's about to pull her up, but she slips on her dress. And she has to fight for the rest of the movie to be together with Jack, because there's always things separating them. There's always things between them. And this is a romance story, and every good romance story has multiple factors working against the central relationship of the story. There are different classes. Rose is engaged. And with time of the movie, the ship is sinking. So everything and everybody is working against those two being together. But they really want to be together. And Rose really wants to be with Jack. And Jack really wants to be with Rose. And you have these situations multiple times throughout the movie that people try to get rid of Jack, especially Cal, because he notices it, that there's something going on. And also the mother of Rose immediately realizes that there's something going on, as it's a dangerous situation. They also try to lock Jack up the later part of the movie to have him basically die or locked away so that he's not near Rose. And Rose has to go there into the sinking part of the ship to save Jack in a pretty hopeless situation. But this is her constantly pushing to be with Jack, because this is the thing that she needs to do. And there's even the one situation pretty late in the movie where she has a chance to leave this sinking ship, because there are rescue boats. It's not enough because it's the Titanic, but women and children are allowed to leave, especially from the first class where she is. She's in the boat, and basically Cal and Jack are lying to her just to get her to be in the boat. But she is being lowered, looking at Jack, and she realizes she can't do that. She should be with Jack. And she jumps back on the ship from the rescue boat onto the ship. And yeah, this is a movie. And a very important part about this whole journey of her and the actions of her is set in a dialogue between Rose and Jack. So Cal notices there's something going on, and he basically tells his henchman, Lovejoy is his name, to keep an eye out for Jack and don't let him be near them. And Jack is dressing up because he's very adaptable. He also dresses in one scene up for the first class and can integrate pretty well. And he pulls her aside and speaks with her and confesses his love to her. But at the same time, he says he cannot save her. And she says something very important. And she says she has to save herself. And this is true. And this is exactly what's happening in the end. And this is also what's happening, and it's necessary in a Jungian sense. You cannot take over the responsibility of the life of someone else, because people are not even completely able to take responsibility for their own life. The necessary sacrifices and the necessary steps have to be done by the person itself. It can't be done for the person. And if you look in stories in general, this is very often how they progress, starting from the middle of the movie pretty much till the beginning of the third act, or even the third act itself, that all the support structures, helpers, tools that people gathered through the story, through the movie, are chipped away one by one, so that it's in the end the person itself alone having to do the sacrifice and having to do the important step themselves. So through her relationship with Jack and through the contact with the Animus, she takes over the masculine traits of Jack. And this is already a move toward being whole and being more integrated. For example, what she learns pretty much immediately is the lying. So they're being found, Jack and Rose, when Jack saved her, and it looks a little bit incriminating. She's a first class passenger and he's somewhere in the third class. She makes up the story because she can't sell it up. No, well, I tried to kill myself. He also taught her spitting, which is now, I can leave this open what it could symbolically look like in an analog, what a man can do, and a woman maybe could not do. She learns punching. And yeah, she uses, for example, the axe with like a sharp blade being the representation of the logos symbology wise. And there's one very important aspect that comes at the very end of the movie as a payoff. He tells her what he wants to teach her. And like, she's also asking them for things. And she wants to learn how to ride like a man, a horse like a man, which one leg on each side. And in the very end, where you see the photos of her life, you can see her on a horse riding like a man. So throughout the movie, she becomes more risk-taking. She becomes more gambling. And she is, yeah, separating herself from the family, being pulled away from her animals. Like, Jack constantly tries to pull her away, but she's also pulled to Jack. So she tries to leave from there on her own. It's not only on his part. And she gets more brave and brave. She goes into the sinking part of the ship to save him. This is interesting, symbology-wise, because water is a representation, symbolically, for the unconscious, as things can disappear there or can suddenly appear. Also very deadly if you go in there unprepared. And she's going into the dark, wet, very loud and dangerous place to save him, to save her animals from the belly of the beast. It's a little bit like in Jonah, who is swallowed by a whale, and she's also going in there. You can even hear the sounds of the ship breaking apart. And she does it. She goes into the unconscious part to get her animals, which is trapped there, and only she can release him from there. Integration, symbology-wise, in dream analysis, to keep it there, is also represented through sex, through mingling, through coming together as a sign of unification. So, well, Jung said, the consciousness is very literal, but the unconscious is very symbolic, and rather using analogs to show something, to express something. This is what I meant with she kills herself, or trying to kill herself, and the meaning is she wants to be unconscious from the situation. Similar, it's sex between two people, but it's meaning unification. And this is interesting because she doesn't have sex with Cal. He tries to bribe her with a necklace and saying, oh, this is very expensive and it's for you. And he expected her later that evening, but she did not come to visit him. But she has sex with Jack, showing the integration process and unification process with her animus. And this goes even further in the very end when she's saved. Of course, she tries to hide from Cal when she arrives in New York. And she gives the wrong name, but she gives a very interesting name, because she gives herself the name of Rose Dawson. It's the same as she would have married Jack to be then really unified with him as a couple, as bonded for life, which is interesting. And then an additional point to really hammer down this point that Jack had this influence and Jack is now part of her. And Rose as a name is also a flower. And interestingly enough, the individuation process is symbolized in the East, in Eastern psychology, as a lotus flower, as the unfolding, like the person with their psychology is unfolding over time. And symmetry, symmetrical round forms showing the roundedness of the person, that everything is there. It's not like half a flower, but it's a complete flower and it's symmetrical. So everything is same as important, same as a person needs to integrate all the things that have in them. And the equivalent in the West is the rose as a flower, symbolizing the individuation process. So she spends a lot of time with Jack. She integrates parts of this being in herself. What happens when they're in the water? He basically saves her as she is on this piece of wood that can only carry one person. And he tells her again that she should never let go. And she said, okay, I will never let go. And he dies then later that night because of hypothermia. It's a little bit cold in the water in the middle of the Atlantic. And she lets him go, but he disappears. And this is, from a Jungian sense, so interesting because she had this psychological need. And this is why he came up. She was trapped. She wanted to end things. She wanted to become unconscious. And then her psyche, herself, sent someone to say, okay, here, this is what you need in this situation, but you also have to make an effort for it. When he is part of her, he dies and he disappears back into the water, back into the unconscious. He returns where he came from. And I don't know what you know about bodies in the water. Bodies normally float, but Jack does not float. He disappears slowly into the dark, into the unconscious, because his job is done. She integrated him and his qualities into her psyche and became a complete being. So the separation did not continue anymore. Because what Jung said, the things that you do not realize in yourself that are part of you, but should be part of you, seem like a separate entity. So the animus is there, or the anima is there, because it is not integrated. It's still foreign. There's not the connection. Ah, this is actually me. This is a point that happened in Fight Club at the final scene where Jack realizes Tyler Durden is me. There is no separation. And then Tyler Durden disappears because this is what's happening with projections. They only exist as long as they are unconscious. As soon as you're aware that this is a projection, teeth to stop, the magic stops. And she has this. She integrated Jack and now he can disappear into the unconscious and this is okay. I told the story only of 1912 when the ship sank, but there's also this framing device of the treasure hunt in the beginning and of the end, where they're trying to find this necklace that Cal gave Rose or wanted to give Rose, and they can't find it, but they find a drawing of her. And she then tells them, oh, here, I was at the ship, and she goes then there to this research ship right above the Titanic to tell her story. And the reason why she wanted to go there again is because it's bringing everything full circle again. She is suddenly there where she started. And this has to do, I think, she dies at the end, the woman, the elderly Rose. The necklace she had the whole time. So by an accident, she got it in her jacket when she got rescued from the boat. But she still had it in her very advanced age of over 100 because it symbolizes something. She had to decide whether she would go with Cal or go with Jack. And what Cal was offering was material goods, materialistic goods. But what Jack was offering was spiritual goods. And this is the thing what she decided for the spiritual goods of Jack. And she denounced the material goods of Cal. And this is why she always kept the necklace and she never sold it to get then rich again, because then she would have been trapped by Cal basically again. And this is also why she goes back to the ship to drop it into the sea, because this is where it belongs. It belongs with Cal and it belongs into the past. And at the same way, she also returns to Jack, because this is open for interpretation, but I interpreted it this way, that she dies quietly in her sleep and has this final vision of being at the ship where everything is like it was 84 years ago. And there's all the people that died in the shipwreck. And there's Jack waiting for her. And this is then the final reunification, because she lived her full completing life. And she is then back with him. And this is what she's been doing for the whole movie, trying to be with him. And then in the end, she succeeds. And there's this interesting notion by Jung regarding consciousness and ego, which is the center of consciousness, and this is you perceiving everything that you can perceive. Ego and consciousness is something that is covered. It's not made, it just appears. It's a phenomena. People suddenly become self-conscious, conscious of themselves. They can say, I. like very small children, they do not say I, but when they start saying I, it means there's something inside of them that perceiving themselves. And he noticed that there are some people who are living their life completely unconscious. And it's only at a certain point that they suddenly become conscious of themselves and of their life. And this is all very often like a not traumatic, but dramatic experience. He had, it's also the story of one patient he had, and she had three children. And like her husband wanted to have more, but she said with the third child, she suddenly stopped doing birth because she said she becomes suddenly aware. She did not realize that everything that happened before, she was just this unconscious automaton being, but this realization of self did not take place yet. So this is also what happened with Rose. Her conscious journey really only started with Jack coming and saving her. And this brings it then full circle because she dies at the place where she was born psychologically. And this is, of course, very satisfying to see and to experience in a movie. And what she does, the treasure hunters a little bit like Cameron maybe was when he started to investigate the Titanic, because he was only interested in the ship. Like, and he looked for money just so somebody pays for it, that he can spend a lot of time with the ship. But through his time there, he learned about the human tragedy and he learned about the human experience. And the treasure hunters themselves also, they're only interested in the ship because there's a treasure and then you get a lot of money. And there's even this one analyst guy who's, he looks a little bit like a nerd, like a technician. He explains to Rose how the ship sank. Of course, it's for the audience. Everybody knows how the ship sank inside the movie. But he's completely, let's say on the logo side, explaining, oh yeah, and this fills and then it breaks and it goes down and pops like cork and so on. It means thousands of people died. And Rose is, very, very interesting how you say it like that, because they're only focused on the material side. But through her telling the story, they become invested in the emotional and also spiritual side, that there is something more. And then they also leave, also because there's no chance they can find the necklace. But for them, the treasure is different. In movie speak and storytelling speak, it is said that characters have a want and a need. And the want part is the thing they're conscious of, but the need part is what's necessary for their psychology and the things that need to happen inside of them. And very often stories are like that, that the character has a clear goal, what they want, and the movie is constantly interfering, trying to give them what they need to be a complete person and to find meaning. This would be Rose's journey. But there's also another big part in the movie, which is the ship itself, symbolizing a lot of things. So for one thing, the ship is man-made. And if we go back to dream analysis, if you look at man-made things, for example, tools or even houses, everything that's done by human beings or has a source there, is representation of ego, of will, and also consciousness. It's a known part. And as I said before, the water, the ocean, this is the unconscious part. So you have the conscious part on top of the unconscious part. And of course, it happens what has to happen, because consciousness is limited and it's not complete, not yet, maybe in the future. There's a lot of one-sidedness and also hubris about it. So consciousness is pretty much convinced that it already knows everything, and the unconscious reminds it constantly that it's not so. Everything about the Titanic is full of hubris. You have this ship, the biggest ship ever done. It's unsinkable. And they have this very amazing journey from Great Britain to New York. And they even want to go faster. Like the machine is brand new, and actually it has to be run in a little bit for those familiar with motors. But they say, oh, we want to be there early and surprise everyone. So it's hubris again. And it does not have enough lifeboats because, it can't sink. Of course, it doesn't have lifeboats. It looks ugly. That's the argumentation why there's not enough lifeboats, because it looks ugly. And this is pure hubris. And you see it then symbolized or represented by a lot of people in the ship that they say, oh, let's do it like this so that it looks good. And in there, because of the higher speed, this is the reason why they hit the iceberg. On one thing is the rudder was not big enough, again, hubris. And the other part is they wanted to go faster, and this is why the trajectory interfered with the iceberg. So, but of course, inside the ship, you have a microcosm of society, and you have then the first class, which is like the most negatively connotated, conscious, one-sided part, and then you have the lower classes at the bottom. Rose being in the conscious part, in the one-sided part, of course, the change comes below, from the lower decks, from Jack. And this is also where all the life is, and where all the excitement is, and the joy is. The parties at the first class, they're dead. They have a strict order, and everybody is nice and polite, and it's all very, not very engaging. But down below, people are drinking, people are dancing, people are having fun. And this is what Jack shows Rose. He takes her from above to below to show her what she does not know, but needs to know. And this is this joy and excitement of the lower decks, of the simpler, closer to life. This follows through the whole movie. You can find this multiple times, that even as the ship is sinking, the first class is saying, oh, we don't want to stand outside waiting for the boats to be lowered because it's loud and it's cold. So they don't take it seriously. And this is also the situation of consciousness, because consciousness is limited. It cannot recognize the things properly. It's a little bit like Dunning-Kruger effect, when you know maybe a little bit about something, but you have the feeling you know everything. And that, of course, creates the source of a lot of problems. And somebody is writing here, denial, which is a very good point. It's basically denial and unableness to adapt and change, which Jack can do. He can adapt very easily. He can change very easily. But in the first class, it's just very stiff and strict and sterile and then dead. And of course, without a future, of course, Rose wants to escape that. And there's another point from a Jungian point. It's very interesting. They're going from Great Britain, from Europe to America. They're going from the old world into the new world. So Jung looked at the psychology of the West and also of different countries. And this was a time when America came up as a country through the First World War and also the Second World War. And he noted that America is the land of renewal, because you lose all the baggage you have from the old world, because Europe is entrenched with thousands and thousands of years of histories and conflicts and everything. He said, in America, people can renew because they're free of the baggage. It also has disadvantages that he noted. But it's interesting to say that she came on board of the Titanic in Europe, in the old world, as an aristocrat, part of the old system. And she comes into America as a nobody, but established herself as a self-made woman with a different name, with a new psychology. She renewed herself through this journey into the new world. So this is a progression for her psychologically, also through geography, which is an interesting point. I don't think that James Cameron read a lot of Jung. It's possible. I would not also say that Titanic is a Jungian work per se, that somebody said, okay, I try to cram in as much as possible things in there. But how Jung approached it was he dug so deep into the psyche of people that he hit the points where all the things are coming from. So it's not a coincidence that James Cameron was drawn to that, and that he presented it in a way that a lot of people were also drawn to that. It's might seem like a coincidence or not. It looks like it's not a coincidence. And it does not have to be conscious decisions all the way. It's just this spoke to him. For artistic, creative people, when something speaks to them, it's very likely that will also speak to a lot of people. In this case, millions and millions and millions of moviegoers. So when you have a movie like that, and the movie is really long, it's 3 hours, and this is Alfred Hitchcock once said, movie should not be longer than the capacity of a bladder of the audience member. That means most movies are 90 minutes or 2 hours. And back then, 3-hour movies were very unconventional. And if you want to do this, you have to do very strong story engines. And I notice this also when I do these presentations, I have to structure it very well and think about, okay, how can I get people to be involved for an hour, for example? It's very different when you do 30 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. And the way to do it is very often archetypal. And you tell people the stories they want to hear, but they don't know yet that they want to hear it. That's a strong engine. You also have, you have romance and you have action, which is already a lot of things. And the movie is structured like this. You have the first part is romance, the second part is action, and it's very, very good action. So the ship sinking, it's amazing. And you see that he really likes the action parts, and maybe the studios were then also happy to see him do it like that. But you try to cover a lot of bases. So having romance, having also comedic elements, having action, having all these things appeals to a lot of people, and then of course draws in the crowd into the theater. And he could do all this because he had complete creative control. So the movies I want to talk about, and I've talked about before, they're very often writer-director movies, which means the director is writing the movies and vice versa. There you have a unified creative and artistic vision, what things should be, and also the control of all the aspects. So it becomes clearer. It becomes muddled when you have somebody directing, 10 people writing, somebody doing here things, then in the middle, people get exchanged and then there are reshoots and so on. It very often creates in a bad movie because it becomes unfocused. It's not streamlined anymore and things are not connected anymore as they could be. So even though that everybody knows the story of Titanic and everybody knows that the ship will sink, people go into the movie and want to see the story. And it's even part of the appeal. It's kind of a ticking time bomb. If it would have been not on the Titanic, it would very likely be very boring. About Jack and Rose, two people find themselves on a ship and then they run away together. But the point where they run away together, where they have sex in the car and she writes this note to Cal that she will leave him, this is a moment where the iceberg hits and that is when it starts to sink. So having a ticking time bomb in the background is an incredibly strong story motor, and you have it in a lot of movies. And this is one of the reasons why the movie can be 3 hours long and feel like a breeze. I saw it this weekend again, so it's very easy just to watch the whole thing and be engrossed the whole time. So the most important thing about a story is always the central relationship. So all really good movies and all good stories that people like, there's a central relationship where everything is centered around. In this case, it's Jack and Rose. And for romance movies, very often they're not, let's say, goal-directed. When you have an action movie, it's goal-directed. Like save the world, get the thing, defeat the bad guy, whatever. But romance movies are very often about question movies. Will or will they not come together? The movie will play with that. So that's another strong engine in this movie, that you have basically both. Will they come together or not? And goal, surviving the ship, putting in a lot of things to make it interesting. And when you want to end the movie, and may you have a good movie, very likely you also have a good ending. The last scene has to be about the central relationship. Or very often it just happens to be that way. That's how people want to have their stories ended, by showing the central relationship. And this is then the conclusion of a 3-hour journey in the end, that Rose dies, goes back to Jack to be finally reunified forever. And this is a scene that punches really hard. And I saw the movie with my wife. And as it ended, she immediately showed me that, I did not know that, she had pictures from this last scene on her smartphone in her photo gallery. It's a point a lot of people connect with. And this is also a point where a lot of people are crying, even men. And I think this is also the perfect scene and point to end my presentation with the last scene of the movie. And I want to thank you for your attention. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And yeah, thank you very much.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Helpdesk. Also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.